And unlike we have heard yesterday, I'm not going to discuss the implementation of the ultraviolet cutoff in a fundamental setting. Rather, I'm going to take toy models for granted and try to use them in order to derive what are the corrections to the inversionary power spectrum that we observe, for instance, in the CME. So the outline of the talk is the following one. First, very briefly, because I know that everybody in this room knows about inflation, I will quickly review how the primordial fluctuations are generated by inflation. And especially, I will spend some time on reviewing the observable status of inflation, given the new data that we have, the WMAP3 data, the CME. Then I will go on and discuss the importance of the initial conditions, and I will try to address the issue of whether the so successful inflationary predictions are sensitive to very high energy physics, and if so, I will try to derive typically which type of correction we get to the inflationary power spectrum. Then, if I have time, I will discuss some criticisms and problems, especially criticisms that have been raised by Alexis Arbulski. And at the end, I will try to use this new inflationary power spectrum, the one with the energy physics correction, and try to see whether we can put constraints on the three parameter which characterize the new physics using the CMB data, so using high accuracy CMB data, the WMAP3 essentially. And then, eventually, at the end, I will round up with conclusions. So just to set up the stage, just a few words about the inflationary scenario. So this is a plot of the inflaton potential versus the vacuum expectation value of the field. We have different shape for the potentials. And if the energy density is larger than the Planck energy density, this is the regime of non-perturbative quantum gravity, so string theory. So I have nothing to say about this regime. Then if you go down, there is a regime where the background field, the background inflaton, is still a regime where the quantum effects for the background field are still important. And this is the regime of stochastic inflation. And again, I'm not going to discuss this regime. And then, if you still go down in energy, then you reach a regime where the background is classical, so you have a classical geometry. The scalar field is classical, and you just have some small fluctuation around this classical background. And we consider that these small fluctuations are of quantum mechanical origin, and they are the seeds of the fluctuation that we observe in the sky. So this is here that the so to say the power spectrum of inflation is produced, is in this region. So of course I will be concerned mainly by this region. And then as the inflaton is rolling down the potential, at some point inflation stops, either because there is violation of the thermal conditions or by instability in the case of hybrid inflation. And then typically the field oscillates at the bottom of the potential, and you have the complicated stage of reheating or preheating. And after a while, you are supposed to smoothly connect to the preheating phase and smoothly connect inflation to the radiation dominated zero. And I will say a few words about this stage in the following. So let me just offer an analogy for the basic mechanisms that is responsible for the production of the detonation at the beginning of let's say during inflation. So I'm going to argue that this mechanism is in fact very similar to the Schrödinger effect. So if you remember the Schrödinger effect, you just have a quantum scalar field and this quantum scalar field phi is interacting with classical electric field. So here is the action, and we have the interaction here in the covariant derivative. Now, if you Fourier transform the field and write down an equation for the Fourier mode, then you obtain this equation, which is the equation of the harmonic oscillator, the frequency of which is time dependent. So this is the equation of motion of the parametric oscillator. And because the frequency is time dependent, if you start out from the vacuum, then you will produce constants. Essentially, what we do during inflation is exactly the same. So the role of the quantum scalar field is played by the metric fluctuations, or it can be slightly more complicated in the case of scalar perturbation, because we have the Buchanan society variables, but essentially this is the role of the scalar field is played by the perturbed metric. And of course, the role of the external classical field is played by the gravitational field, so by the Pond field is the scale factor of the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker geometry. So as in the Schlinger effect, the amplitude or the number of particles created is controlled by the strength of the electric field, we expect the power spectrum of the fluctuation to be controlled by the strength of the gravitational field, and the strength of the gravitational field is of course what's in the Hubble parameter during inflation. So we expect the amplitude of the power spectrum to be given by some power of the Hubble parameter measured in Gaussian. And this is exactly what we will get.
Is your scalar field charged?
You mean in the cosmological context?
Well, in your action, you have a pi star, and since you have an interaction with electromagnetism, is that scalar field pi possess a charge?
Yeah, it's good.
Right. And so the same scalar field which possesses a charge is played by perturbations in the metric?
Yeah, it's just an energy, of course. There is no charge for the metric.
Energy is a charge. I mean, it's how it's coupled to gravity, it's how it's coupled to the vector field.
So, let's push this analogy. So, as I said at the beginning, so we have a classical background, and on top of the classical background, we have this small fluctuation. So, it's a bit like a dry soil with some small fluctuation around. So in the very early universe, we know that these fluctuations are small, so we just do a linear expansion of the metric, and this is the most general form that you can come up with. So you have two types of perturbation. The first type are the so-called scalar perturbation, characterized here in the metric by four functions, phi, b, psi, and e. And you have the gravitational waves, HIG, this tensor is transverse and transverse, and they represent gravitational waves. So we have these two types of perturbation, and it's convenient to, just at the technical level, to Fourier transform this fluctuation. So this is what we do. We extract a trivial damping term, which is just due to the fact that the universe is bending, so we just extract 1/a, where a is a scale factor, and we are left with the Fourier amplitude, which is time dependent. And in order to study the dynamics and the production of the perturbation, what we have to do is to study the time behavior of this Fourier amplitude. And so there is, of course, one Fourier amplitude for each scale. And since we are working at the linear level, each Fourier amplitude evolves independently. This is the whole advantage of Fourier transforming the perturbed metric. And so let me just say a word about the evolution of a given scale during inflation. I guess everybody knows this. So this is the evolution of value scales versus time, essentially. So the blue curve, solid one, is the evolution of the Hubble lens, and the dotted dashed lines, so the red, the blue, and the green ones, are the evolution of the wavelengths of a given mode. So at the beginning of inflation, the modes are within the Hubble radius. Then at some point during inflation, they exit the Hubble radius. They spend some time outside the Hubble radius, and eventually, either during radiation-dominated or matter-dominated era, depending on their wavelengths, they re-enter the horizon. Okay. So now the only thing that we need is an equation of motion for the Fourier amplitude of a given mode. And in order to get this equation, well, we just write down the Perturbot-Einstein equation at first order. And then you can show that every type of perturbation, so either scalar or gravitational waves, obey the same kind of equation, namely, again, the equation of parametric oscillators. So exactly as it was the case for the Schlinger wave. So it's like this equation is like the equation for the pendulum, the length of which is changing with time. Of course, the frequency, the time dependent frequency, is not the same for density perturbation or for gravitational waves. So for, maybe I start with gravitational waves. So in the case of gravitational waves, the time dependent frequency is given by this expression. So it depends on the bound field, on the scale factor, up to the second order derivative. For density perturbation, it's slightly more complicated. It also, of course, only depends on the scale factor, but you see that these times it depends on the scale factor and its derivative up to fourth order, because there is this gamma terms, which is given in terms of the time derivative of the conformal Hubble parameter. So you see that this contains second derivative of the scale factor, and we have still a second derivative here. So the effective frequency goes up until the fourth derivative of the scale. So once you know the evolution of the background, once you know the evolution of the scale factor, you know exactly this equation and you can solve the equation. Another way of studying this equation, which I find quite nice, is to see this equation as a Schrödinger time independent equation. Because you see that using the form of the effective frequency, the equation of motion for the Fourier amplitude is exactly similar to the Schrödinger equation. Here, k squared plus the role of the energy, and here we have an effective potential which is time dependent and which depends on the scale factor. So if we push this analogy, we have the following. So this is typically a plot of this effective potential that you get during inflation. So typically, so this is the shape of the potential for power low inflation, but this is also valid for slow low inflation. So it's quite general. So you have during inflation, typically the effective potential goes as eta minus 2, eta is the conformal time. And then you have the complicated stage of the reheating, and the potential goes down during the radiation dominated era. So there is a perfect correspondence between this plot that you might know very well and this one which is not so known. So when the mode, the typical Fourier mode, is within the other radius at the beginning of inflation, in this picture, this corresponds to a wave which is above the potential. So in this case, the wave is oscillating. And in this picture, of course, it's oscillating simply because the mode thinks that it lives in Minkowski spacetime because the wavelength is so small that it cannot fit the convention of spacetime, so it's just oscillating. Then at some point, as I said before, the mode exits the Hubble radius during inflation, and it corresponds to this point, namely the mode interacts with the barrier. And then you have a decaying mode and a growing mode, and then eventually the mode re-enters the horizon, and this corresponds to the mode exiting the barrier again. So, okay, this is the basic framework. Then, how do we choose the initial conditions? So, as I said before, initially, at the very beginning of inflation, the wavelength of the typical Fourier mode is very small in comparison with the Hubble lens. Therefore, the situation is equivalent to Minkowski. And therefore, we choose the Minkowski vacuum or the bunch Debye vacuum. This means that as eta is going to minus infinity, we require this behavior for the mode function. And you see that you can do this only because we are doing inflation. Because if you don't have inflation, then initially all the modes would be super Hubble. It's only because we have inflation, and it's only because the Hubble radius becomes constant in the past that initially the modes are within the Hubble scale, and that we can fix well-defined initial conditions. And then, starting from this vacuum initial condition, because the perturbative metric is interacting with the background space-time, in the very same way as the quantum scalar field was interacting with the electric field, starting from the vacuum, we will produce some particles. And so, in the classical picture, we will produce cosmological perturbations, inflationary cosmological perturbations. Okay? And then the question is how we link this framework to some observable quantities. So what we are able to do now is to solve this equation for the Fourier amplitude. We have well-defined initial conditions. If we know the background, starting from this well-defined initial condition, we can solve from the Fourier amplitude. And how do we relate this Fourier amplitude to some observable quantities? Well, usually, what we do is that we compute the multiple moments. So this is just a two-point correlation function of the delta T over T. So delta T over T are just the fluctuation of the temperature of the CMB. And you can show that this C of L is given in terms of the two-point correlation function, either of gravitational waves or of density perturbations in this way. Just the calculation of the two-point correlation function. And the power spectrum, either for gravitational wave or scalar perturbation, is given in terms of this Fourier amplitude. So once you know mu, you can compute the power spectrum, hence the two-point correlation function, hence the fluctuation of this. So let's try to do it for a very simple system. So I take again the example of power law inflation. And I do it for gravitational wave because this is simple. So in the case of power law inflation, the effective frequency is given by this. As I said, the effective potential scale is 1 over theta squared. This means that effective potential is like that, versus time. So, let's consider the first region 1. So the region where the wavelength of the mode is smaller than the Hubble scale. In this case, this term, so the effective potential is negligible, because the wave is above the barrier, and therefore you can solve for this equation very easily. And you get the combination of a positive and negative frequency, but because of the initial condition, you choose only one branch. And you So you start from this loop. So in this regime, we have this loop.
Is that K the co-moving thing?
Cool.
So just wondering about the condition that it be greater than A double prime over A.
Yes, it's the same as the physical wavelength smaller than the current.
Well, that condition.
Yeah, this condition is, in fact, the physical wavelength of the mode
just translates.
Just translate in terms of co-moving. Now let's consider the other regime, namely when the wave is interacting with the barrier. So in, let's say region 3, so this time is the opposite. This k square term is subdominant and the potential is dominant. And you see that an obvious solution to this equation is that proportional to the scale factor times some k dependent constant. This regime, we have this solution, and if we are interested in the amplitude of the perturbable metric, as I said at the beginning, we have just extracted one over A, so this means that the amplitude of the perturbable metric is just given by C of K. And now the goal is to compute this C of K. And to do that, it's extremely simple. The only thing that we have to do is to join the two solutions. The solution in the, let's say, sub-level regime, and the solution in the super-level regime. And you see that the time of matching is just given by the condition that k squared is a double prime over a, and this implies a k-dependent time of matching time. So this is clear because if you consider another mode, so maybe this would be like that, and it's clear that the matching time won't be the same. Okay, so maybe now I can do the rest of the calculation of the work problem. So what we have to do is to write that exponential over square root of 2k is c of k, and now the scale factor at the time of matching. So this is 1 over k over 1 plus beta. This is the scale factor for power of inflation. And from that, you get immediately C of K, and once you have C of K, you immediately get the spectrum. The spectrum is, as I showed before, it's just mu divided by A squared times K to the third. So this gives this. You extract C of K from that, and you find that this is K to the power 2 beta. So usually it's not, I mean, for historical reasons, people define the spectral index as n minus 1. So you immediately read that the spectral index in this case is 2 beta plus 1. And now you just compute it for the sitter space time. So for beta equal to minus 2, and you obtain n is equal to 1. And this is, of course, the famous result of inflation that when you are close to the sitter expansion, then the Bohr spectrum is close to scale factors. And you see that this is really a part of the envelope calculation.
But how good is this approximation of just matching approximate solutions?
So in the case of power law inflation, it's even exact. I mean, in the case of power law inflation, there is no need to match the solution. You can solve the equation exactly. You can solve it in terms of best functions. And then, you can prove that the spectral index is exactly this one.
But
the amplitude then of course the amplitude you cannot predict exactly is the signal. There is something like 10% of the spectrum is X, you can predict exactly.
It's just a leading K again. So that's quite robust at this point.
Okay. So of course, I mean, we don't want to do just power regression. We want to study a large class of inversionary dimensions. So in order to describe this, so to say, microphysics of inversion, we introduce the slow-roll parameters. So here I am introducing just two slow-roll parameters, and they just describe the shape of the potential. So we have the first slow-roll parameter, which is proportional to the first derivative of the infinite potential. The second one is linked to the second derivative of the inflationary potential, and you could define the whole hierarchy of slow parameters. And for any model in the plan epsilon 1, epsilon 2, you can draw points which represents a particular dimension. So usually, if you restrict yourself to single field inflation, usually people are considering three classes of models: large field models, like the blue curves; small field models, the red one; or hybrid models. Oh.
If you want to intervene, the central input in these models is that you have to have many, many e-foldings. That makes the epsilon small. Why is the epsilon small?
Right, so
we have a potential, so at the VD5.
Yeah.
So it's the essential input that the epsilon is small because we have to begin sufficiently high that there are many e-foldings. Why is epsilon small?
I think simply because I'm not sure this yet, because you want you can compute.
My question is that you said in the perfect decision space, where h squared is constant,
yeah.
So you don't have any change of phi.
So exactly.
And then epsilon, and then you don't have any epsilon. So
epsilon 1 is 0.
My question is the epsilon small because the universe varies slowly through most of the time.
No, so for the C-term, all the smaller parameters are zero because the potential is exactly flat.
Yeah.
And so you get the and then you get the scaling by the power spectrum.
Epsilon is small because it changes slowly.
So you need a small epsilon because you need a spectral index close to scaling bounds, because otherwise this would be already ruled out. So you need, I mean, in order to produce a spectral index which is close to scaling variance, you need small epsilon. There is no fundamental reason for having. I mean, you could produce a potential where epsilon is big, but in this case, the corresponding power spectrum would have a strong tilt, which is already a ruled out.
The universe changed fast. So you didn't have a lot of e-foldings. So you would be very far from the decision space. Then wouldn't you be very far from the scaling invariance spectrum? Isn't the scaling invariance the corollary of the long-lasting inflationary
spectrum? No, it's not. They are independent. Because the length of inflation depends both on the initial value of the scalar field and on the flatness of the potential.
Yes.
So for a fixed epsilon,
yes,
you can have many different lengths of inflation. So these are two different things.
Oh,
so what Jerome is saying is that
so they're not tightly covered.
They're not.
I think the potential has to be flat in the regime where the scales cross the Hubble radius during inflation. But the potential could be something else elsewhere. You just need flatness of the potential close to flatness of the potential in the region which corresponds when the scans exit the horizon, the Hubble scan theory. Okay? So, now we describe the model of inflation by just the value of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And, yeah, now what I want to do is to briefly give a slight overview of the observational situation using WMAPS3 data. So, using this data, we can constrain the values of the threshold parameters. So, this is a plot of epsilon 1 versus epsilon 2. And here are the constraints coming from WMAPS3. This is the same plot, but instead of epsilon 1, I have plotted log of epsilon 1. And this is working at the first threshold order. So the inflationary power spectrum is described only in terms of epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So what you can obtain is an upper constraint on epsilon 1, this one, and this constraint on epsilon 2. And this is telling you that a scaling variance spectrum is still compatible with the data. There have been many discussions in the literature about this. But I think it's fair to say that, unfortunately, because it would be very good for inflation to exclude the scaling variance case, unfortunately, NS equal to 1 is still compatible with the data.
What goes into these plots? So you have to deal with the post-inflationary integrated sexual.
So you compute the power spectrum of the fluctuations in the Sorrell approximation. It depends on the value of the Sorrell parameters. And then you just put or feed this power spectrum into a CNB code like CNBFast.
Oh, so that's all, and that includes all the physical effects.
And then it includes all, yeah, exactly, when the modes re-enter the horizon. And then you test the results, you compare the result with the data, and you evaluate the likelihood, and from the likelihood you get this control. So, so we also have upper bound on the value of the Hubble parameter. This is this one. And we have upper bound on the contribution of gravitational waves. So we know now that gravitational waves are less than 20% of what we see in the CNB. Now you can test for the running. So this means going one step further in the Sorrell hierarchy. You have to introduce a third Sorrell parameter. And in the case where you introduce a third Sorrell parameter, you get these four contours. So this is epsilon 1 versus epsilon 2. But taking into account epsilon 3, this is the same thing but with log of epsilon 1. And this is the plot of epsilon 3 versus epsilon 1, epsilon 3 versus log of epsilon 1. So what you can see is that you don't get any real constraint on epsilon 3. In this case, you can close the contour, which would correspond to, let's say, detection with quotation mark of a positive epsilon 3, which would correspond to a negative running. But you see that if you change the prior, this constraint completely disappears. So you cannot get any prior independent detection of the running. So I think it's fair to say that at the present stage, we have no evidence for a non-vanishing running. And finally, I will show in the next transparency that you can get some very weak constraints on the reheating temperature for a specific class of models.
When you calculate the scalar index, NS,
yes,
you always get logarithmic correctness, which predict an inflation that NS should be less than 1. WMAP3 data doesn't hold up to that.
Well, first of all, I don't think that NS should be less than 1. For instance, if you consider the hybrid model, then NS can be...
Single field, no.
The precise statement is, if you want to end inflation by violation of the Slowell conditions, then NS, and if you consider single field inflation, then NS has to be less than 1. But you can, I mean, you can consider hybrid inflation, so this is hybrid inflation, the green curve, and you can view it as a single field model. And in this case, you can perfectly get a blue spectrum.
But then, of course, since the
epsilon parameter, the Slowell parameter, is increasing as the field is going down the potential, you have to end inflation by another mechanism. And so this is here that you need another field to stop inflation by instability.
But you
see that WMAP3 data does not indicate that the spectral index is red. You can see it very clearly on this plot. It's true only if you assume that gravitational waves are negligible, because gravitational waves negligible means epsilon 1 very small. So you go in this part of the plot. And you see that indeed, in this part of the plot, you have, so to say, with quotation mark again, a detection of a non-vanishing epsilon 2. And in this language, this would imply a red tilt for the spectrum. But, I mean, if epsilon 1 is not small, so if you have a non-negligible contribution of gravitational waves, then you can perfectly get a blue spectrum with the data now.
Not what we want from inflation is a prediction, a hard prediction that you can test.
Yeah.
And once you get into the hybrid model, you've got more parameters. You're now saying that gravitational waves are negligible, so you won't see the beam modes. And so the thing is losing a lot of predictability.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that gravitational waves are negligible.
It's the
people who want to claim that the WMAP3 data indicate a red tilt that assume that the gravitational waves are negligible, but I'm not doing that. I'm saying exactly the opposite. I mean, there are a priori no reasons to assume that the gravitational waves are negligible. If you don't make this assumption, then I think you cannot conclude from the data that the spectrum is red. At this stage, of course. Maybe with the Planck data, this would be possible. But using the WMAP3 data, I think it's simply not possible. But nevertheless, you can constrain some very specific models of inflation. And I'm now going to show how you can rule out some inflationary models using the WMAP3 data. So for instance, let's consider large field models. So where the potential is given by this, it's characterized by the free parameter of P. And this is again a plot of epsilon 1 versus epsilon 2. And here you have different prediction for different values of p. So the quadratic model, so the massive model, is just here along the blue line. And while you increase p, you just go up in this diagram. So now what we have done we have tested explicitly the inflationary prediction for this particular model. So we have just given up the Slowell approximations. We have built up a code, numerical code, where the power spectrum is computed exactly, so no need of any Slowell approximation. And we have coupled this code to a CMB code in order to get the exact prediction from this model. So the only assumption in this case is just the validity of the linear approximation for cosmological perturbations.
What do you assume about the end of inflation in this model? do you just abruptly toss out the potential at some point?
So it's a very good point. In the case where you have this exact model for the for inflation, you need to say something about rating, because you need to say how you relate scales that we see today to the scales during inflation. And so you need to know the entire history of the universe. So what we have done, we have modeled the rating stage by a phase characterized by its number of fifolds and its equational state. So we have two free parameters. The equation of state being such that its equation of state parameter, p over rho, is greater than minus 1 star. Because we don't want acceleration, of course, during the reading stage. And these two things are free parameters in the model that you can constrain using the data. So here is an explicit example. You see this R. This R is just a combination of the number of fifolds during reheating and the equation of state during reheating. So what you can do is you can use the data in order to try to... So you have two extra parameters, and you can try to constrain these two extra parameters. So in other words, you can try to constrain the reheating temperature using the data. Because you see, I think it's easy to understand. If you change the description of the reheating stage, so if you change the number of fifolds during reheating, or the equation of state parameter during reheating, this means that you change how you link the scales that we see now to the scales during inflation. So if you change the number of fifolds during reheating, it means that the scale will move a little bit along the inflationary potential. And this means that the spectral index will be different, because you don't probe the same part of the potential. And it's clear that there is a limit to this process, because otherwise you would get a spectrum which is too red or too blue according to the data. So it's clear that you are not free to move the number of fifolds during reheating as much as you can. So in this way, this is the way you can understand that using this data and using this setup, you can put constraint on the reheating temperature.
So you mentioned a few times the number of fifolds. Do you have a kind of likelihood for the number of fifolds?
No, I don't have that.
Because it's impossible? Like, it's related to the fact there is no constraint on the reheating, or it's something else?
No, I mean, I don't...
No, in principle, you could have.
Exactly, this is what I mean.
And what is the mean?
No. I don't know. Oh. But I mean, it's just...
No, I cannot...
I could do the calculation, but it's there. I mean, it's there. You know, the R contains the number of fifolds during...
So there is a kind of prediction, of there is a kind of constraint, experimental constraint.
Yeah, the number of fifolds, not the total number of fifolds.
No, from our...
From, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jerome, one more little thing. Is it valid to ask what's the value of phi at the end of inflation? Or does that play no role in anything here?
No, you can ask this question, of course. The end of, so in this framework, the end of inflation is just defined by epsilon 1 is equal to 1. So you could translate this condition to, I mean, you could compute from this condition the value of the vacuum expectation value.
But the equation of motion for the inflaton have an imaginary part, an I gamma phi.
This is what's bothering me too. We're just sitting somewhere on the potential, and suddenly you just turn it off and switch to a completely different equation of state. What's the physics that's supposed to be behind that?
So for this model of rating, we are using the old-fashioned way of doing it, namely, you exactly as you said, we add the gamma phi dot to the Klein-Gordon equation.
So just it decayed at that point.
Exactly. And then you add the corresponding term to the equation of conservation of radiation, so that the total energy is conserved. And you can integrate these two equations and get the evolution of the radiation energy density. And once you reach the time which is equal to 1 over gamma, so the lifetime of the inflaton, you just say that this energy density is equal to T to the 4.
Right. And what about the fact that it happened at the same time everywhere in the universe, observable universe? Is that plausible from decay of phi?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's just in this simple framework, gamma is a constant.
But how strongly do your results depend on these assumptions about reheating, which are, I think, the weakest part of the whole scenario, or at least the most complicated part of the whole scenario? Because preheating might be way out of thermal equilibrium for some time. So, you know, if there's a strong theory result, if it's sensible to this.
For single field inflation, I don't think so. The only thing which matters for the perturbation is really the number of E4 that you are getting reheating for single field inflation, because the perturbation on a large scale won't be affected by the complicated stage of preheating. For two fields, it's maybe more complicated than this. But for single field inflation, I think the only thing which matters is to relate the scales that we see in the CMB today to the scales during inflation.
I mean, this is an explicit one. So if you just have one field, then you can have...
Yeah, you have a conserved quantity, and therefore...
Right, that is the usual argument why we don't have to worry so much.
You do the analysis explicitly using this. Preheating of metric perturbations, and the preheating of metric perturbations for the adiabatic mode is adiabatic, whereas for entropy modes it's real.
Yeah.
So if you have entropy perturbations which are not exponentially suppressed during inflation, then preheating may have crucial differences. Mm-hmm. And you may roll out all classes of models.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think the preheating is the most complex part of the whole scenario, but the question was really. This sounds to be a much more ambitious program than just trying to figure out slow roll parameters. If you really want to match to a specific
potential,
would it be fair to say that in the case of potentials that have a long self-similar phase, that where it does not depend exactly on which part of the potential you're sitting while producing the scales that are cosmologically relevant today, then the phase of reheating becomes less important? Because it essentially determines the value of phi at the time the cosmologically relevant perturbations are produced.
Well, again, I would say that if you consider a single field inflation, mm-hmm. then the details of the preheating stage are not important. The only thing which matters is which part of the potential you probe when you exit the Hubble scale during inflation. And this depends on how you relate those scales with the physical scale that we observe.
Right. But it depends on the kind of potential that you're probing.
Exactly.
In some potentials it's important, some potentials it doesn't matter.
Exactly. And I will show an explicit example. So given the data for large field model, it's not important. We can put constraints on the reading temperature yet. But on the next slide, you will see that you start getting some constraints on the very weak constraints. Okay, so maybe the most interesting part is this one. So this is the distribution of, let's say, the probability for values p. And you see that at 2 sigma, with the data that we have now, you exclude any model with p larger than 3.1. So this is an explicit example for a particular model of the sentence that I have written many times in grant proposals, that with high accuracy CMB data, you can rule out some inflationary models. Is it here in an explicit example? And if you try to constrain the reheating temperature in this model, basically you don't get any constraints.
Can you explain why?
Again, I think it's still, I mean...
It's like a null direction, in a sense.
it's always the same thing. It means that for the particular case of chaotic model or large field models, you are still free to move around the potential without getting a two red or two blue spectral index. It's still compatible with the accuracy of the data.
And nevertheless, the number of default can be constrained.
Not in this case. Not in this case.
I see.
But so, here is a case where you can put constraints. So this is the small field model now. So it's characterized by two free parameters, P and mu. And in this case, you don't get, so I have no time, because I think I'm already running out of time. But you have no real constraint on P. It's a bit more complicated, but essentially you have no real constraint on P. But in this case, nevertheless, you get a constraint on the reheating temperature. So you see that it's a very, very weak constraint. Namely, if you assume that the equation of state during reheating is close to this limit, to minus 1/3, so it's a very extreme model, probably not realistic at all, then you only from the CMB you can get this constraint on the reheating temperature. So it's clear that at this stage it's not so interesting, but because it's so weak that you cannot really learn about the stage of reheating, but I think it shows that with maybe the Planck data, when we will get stronger constraint on the spectral index, really we will be able to say something for some particular model, in particular this small thing model, we will be able to say something on the reheating temperature, which I think is quite interesting.
How do you get this constraint on the reheating? What's the physics of that?
It's again the same thing that I have said before. So you just model the reheating stage by two free parameters, the number of e-fold and the equation of state. And according to the number of e-fold that you have, you just move the scales.
It has a lot to do with the density of states that the inflaton decays into, and the number of quanta. This temperature is reflecting the number of quanta that the inflaton decays into.
Yes, this is just
part of it.
Writing that the energy density of radiation is proportional to T to the 4. Nothing more. So you see, in this case, the shape of the potential is not the shape of large field models. And in this case, in the case of this extreme equation of state for reheating, given the WMAPS3 data, you are no longer free to move along the potential. And this is how you get this very weak constraint.
So when omega is closer to minus 1/3, how much are, what are the values of epsilon, the Sloural parameters? They are still very small?
No, Sloural parameter, here, it's larger than minus 1/3. It's during reheating, so we don't, inflation has already stopped. So you have inflation, when epsilon 1 is 1, inflation stops, and then you connect this inflationary phase to the reheating phase characterized by this omega and the number of e-fold. And then you smoothly connect this phase to the radiation dominated diagram.
So this omega is related to the decay rate of the inflaton, or it's an additional parameter? I thought it was gamma that was somehow regulating, parametrizing.
Yeah. Yeah, but you need two parameters. You need, so gamma is equivalent to the number of, you can re-express gamma as the number of e-fold during reheating, but you need also to say something about the equation of state. During the reheating. So you need two parameters. Because for the same amount, let's say for the same amount of time during reheating, depending of the equation of state, you can get different e-folds.
So omega drops from inflation to that value, and then that value to radiation elimination. It's not an interpolation from one to the other, a smooth interpolation.
Yes, so it's a matching. It's a matching from the inflationary phase, then to the reheating phase, where omega can change from minus one-third to one. Right. And then you smoothly connect this part to the radiation-dominated era, where omega is one-third.
And you prefer this than the smooth interpolation? Because we have the initial and the final value. In a sense, the initial value being given by V and the final by radiation.
Yeah, no, we need just a matching because...
well, if you study the dynamics at the scalar field, in the radiation phase, you have to get time and awesome.
What I want to say is that this could be characterized by an analysis instead of making a matching.
No, I'm saying if you actually follow the scalar field dynamics.
Why not use that value in the right? Why not use that physics or that behavior within the numerical analysis?
But you can do it for large field models. For large field models, when the field is oscillating at the bottom of the potential, you can compute the equation of state during reheating. You can link the equation of state during reheating to this power index P.
I see.
And of course, we have used that. But this is true only for large field models.
So here, there is no prediction, in a sense, from the model.
No, no.
Just a second. The equation of state during the reheating, are you saying that does not depend on because you are creating the actual processes out in the same channel, so to speak?
Yeah, of course, but it's just a simple model.
Of course it depends, but it's unknown.
So you're just subsuming everything into parameters.
You see, when you consider these large field models, you can show that when you add this gamma phi dot, which describes the decay of the inflaton, you can show that the behavior of the scale factor is given by a constant equation of state. So we have just used this model not only for large field models, but also for hybrid and small field models. Just a phenomenological description of the reheating phase. But we have not touched at all the complicated stage of preheating and explosive particle production. But I believe that, as I said before, that in this framework, it's not so important for single field inflation.
So just a last question. How reasonable it is minus one third? Is it just the border of...
Yeah,
the
I think it's not reasonable. It's just the border, really the border. Because we have considered values of the equation of state from minus one third to one, because reheating is something, is a phase where the acceleration is no longer accelerated, where the expansion is no longer accelerated. So, I mean, it's just to show that already with this data you can put very weak constraints, but it's clear that it's an extreme case.
What about adding a slight prior? So there is no way to decently characterize omega
For small field models?
Yeah, for this type of model. There is nothing, we cannot say anything that we can bet on, just to make.
The universe doesn't even need to be described by an equation of state in this phase. It does not need to be in some like equilibrium.
Effectively, it will be described by something.
If it still behaves like a perfect fluid, which during that
we have the initial and the final value. Make a big mistake.
But in the case of large field models, you can show this.
Okay. Yes. If you have entropy perturbations, then there's a huge difference between modeling the W using the scalar field oscillations and just interpolating. Orders of magnitude missing. But only in more complicated models. Only multiple.
Can you explain this to us in your talk?
I can explain to you.
So you would have, you see, sufficiently, the effect would be sufficiently important to modify the extraction like this one. I understand
it's
a kind of spectrum, but does it accumulate so as to...
Yes, large passes of two field long is an inflation, which you can write down just completely roll down, because bad things happen during the meeting. But this is not the class of
models. Yeah, it's clear and clear. I'm just focusing on a single thing.
No,
wasn't.
But just
that shows you that actually
you have to be careful with just a smooth interpolation. So I think that with the Planck data, it will be possible to constrain the reheating temperature, at least in this case, in a much more efficient way. And I think this is really something that is interesting for the future. Okay, so that's it for this small review of the observational status of inflation. So maybe I just summarize what we have learned. Scale invariance is still possible. We have an upper constraint on the energy scale of inflation. We have upper constraint on the contribution of gravitational wave, no running, and very weak constraint on the reheating temperature. This is, I think, a fair summary of what we can say about inflation given the WMAPs we did. Okay, so I think I have a problem of time now because it's only the beginning of my talk and there is only 25 minutes left. So. Okay, I just go on and I stop at
15. You've been discussing well.
Okay. So now let me discuss the subject of this workshop, namely the sensitivity of the inflationary prediction to a modification of high energy physics. So it's clear from these calculations that assuming that the initial amplitude of the mode is proportional to 1 over square root of k is crucial in order to get the scale invariant spectrum. If you don't have this, it's clear that given the De Sitter spacetime, or almost the De Sitter spacetime, you don't get any. You don't get any scale invariant spectrum. So here I just repeat what the so-called transponderant problem.
Means for the ignorant?
Initial conditions. Initial conditions. Initial conditions. So I think I don't need to repeat what the transponderant problem is. When we just go backwards in time. All the scales that are physically relevant for us today, the scales that we see in the CNB today, were smaller than the Planck length. And so we can question the framework that we use, namely field theory in curve space-time. And we can question the initial condition that we use in order to get the scale invariant power spectrum. So I have one remark on this question. It's the following. You know that recently people have tried to construct models based on string theory. Usually they end up with something which looks like quite different from inflation. Namely, they end up with a bouncing universe. This is the case for the pre-Lidman model or the ekperiodic model. So you have a contracting phase and the universe reaches some minimal size and then you have the expanding phase we live in. And what these people are doing, you fix the initial condition in the contracting phase and you can generate a scale invariant power spectrum from scales which are beyond the Hubble scale before the bounds. And the whole question is to propagate this initial power spectrum through the modes. And this is here that we have problems, because usually the quantum gravity correction in this regime are very important. So this means that also you can fix well-defined initial condition and compute in a well-defined way an initial power spectrum. It's very difficult to propagate this power spectrum through the modes. And in some sense, the transport time problem for inflation, it's a bit the same. And it's clear that if we fix the Bunch-Davis initial conditions here, then from these initial conditions, we can evolve the universe and produce the scaling bound power spectrum. But if we go backward in time, we also reach again a regime where quantum gravity correction could be important, exactly in the same way as in this bouncing universe. So in some sense, I think it's interesting to remark that we hit again the same problem. So I wanted to do this remark. So now I go to the main subject, namely, okay, we have these transport time problems. Now, can we use some toy models which would describe how physics is modified on very high energy scales? And can we use this toy model to predict what will be the correction in the inflationary power spectrum? And given this inflationary power spectrum, can we test this inflationary power spectrum using the data? And can we put some constraints on the free parameter describing the movie? So this is the goal. So some remarks. First of all, I think that some people would say that it's true that there is this transquantum problem, but we don't know nothing about quantum gravity, so we know nothing about how we could compute this correction. So I think that some people would just say, okay, there is this problem, but I just stop at this stage. I think it's a perfectly legitimate attitude. It's not the one that I am going to adopt, but it's still possible. Now, what we are going to do is to try to test the robustness of the inflationary predictions. So we are going to use toy models and try to see whether the inflationary predictions are modified or not. So obviously, these modifications are phenomenological. I'm going to use this modified dispersion relation or this minimal approach where the scales pop up at a given time. And it's clear that when you test the robustness of inflationary production through this modification, I mean, first of all, these considerations are very speculative, and hence they are quite limited because they just refer to this phenomenological approach. And the fourth remark that I wanted to do is that the new scale at which the new physics pops up is not necessarily the Planck scale, but it could be the string scale or something like this. Just has to be higher than the Hubble scale. So I think it's, at least for me, it's important to keep in mind these remarks. So now the question is, given the transquantum problem, given that we have a new scale which characterizes the appearance of the new physics, the question is which kind of modification can we imagine to test the robustness of the inflationary predictions. So a first class that Robert and I have studied a long time ago now is to assume that there is a modified dispersion relation. So in this case, if I just consider the analogy with the crystal again, so the classical background, as I said at the beginning, is like a crystal, and the fluctuations are like the phonons which propagate on top of this crystal. Now, in this analogy, it's clear that when the wavelength of the phonon reaches the typical size of the lattice, then you expect some deviation from the dispersion relation. And here, this is exactly the analogy that we use. We expect some deviation of the dispersion relation when the wavelength of the given Fourier mode reaches the new scale. And I think one advantage of this approach, as I'm going to show, is that this allows us to identify what is needed beyond the Planck scale in order to get a modification of the inflationary spectrum. And to say it quickly, what we need beyond the Planck scale is a breakdown of the WKB approximation. If you have a breakdown of the WKB approximation, then you will modify the inflationary power spectrum. If you don't, then the inflationary power spectrum will remain the same. So, what does that mean in terms of our equation of motion for the Fourier model of the perturbations? So, it simply means that the common linear wave number now becomes time dependent. And that the time dependence of this commoving wave number is given in terms of the wind dispersion relation. So we still have the equation of parametric oscillator, but the time dependence of the frequency of this parametric oscillator is modified by the fact that we have a new dispersion relation. So now the question is, given this new dispersion relation, for which kind of dispersion relation do we get a modification, and for which kind do we get the same result? And so this is now the question that I'm going to address. And for that, I just would like to make a small break, and for two or three slides, to address a different question. And you will see the link at the end. So now what I would like to do is to show you that computing the inflationary power spectrum on large scales is exactly similar to computing the energy levels of the hydrogen atom. So it sounds a bit strange, but I hope to convince you that this is true. So let's consider a system like the hydrogen atom. So we have a nucleus, and we have an electron orbiting around the nucleus, and between them, so the distance is r. We know that if we write down the Schrödinger equation, then we have this equation with this r-dependent frequency. So you see that this frequency is, if you forget about this term, which is proportional to 1 over the distance, but if you forget about this term, this effective frequency is exactly the effective frequency that we get in the cosmological case. The distance between the nucleus and the electron playing the role of the conformal time. So this means that computing the wave function close to the nucleus, that is to say for small values of r, is exactly like computing the power spectrum on large scales. And computing the wave function far from the nucleus, that is to say for large value of r, is exactly similar to computing the wave function on sub-level scales. So there is there is even a perfect analogy between the L, which is the momentum, and the beta, which is the power of the scale factor. You have this structure, LL plus 1, beta, beta plus 1. So it's exactly the same. And it turns out that in the 30s, people have tried to apply the WKB approximation to this problem. So what they did is the standard things. You use the W approximation. So you, from this, you end up with the Bose-Ahlefeld quantization rule. So you just have to compute this integral along the classical trajectories, and you write that this integral has to be equal to 2 pi n plus 1 half, n is the quantum number, and from this you can get the energy levels of the atoms, which depends on L because it's already encoded into the frequency, and which depends on n because it's here. And you end up with this equation for the Balmer. This is the Balmer equation. And if you do this, it's very straightforward. If you do this, you get a wrong result. Because this factor is wrong. L plus square root of L plus 1 should be, in fact, replaced by L plus 1 half squared. So if you compare this equation to the data that the people had in the 30s, you simply get something which does not fit. And the people at that time, so the atomic physicists, realized that this equation was wrong. But during 10 years, they were not able to figure out why this result was wrong. And so what they did, you can check in the literature, it's quite funny. What they did is that they just replaced this wrong factor NL plus 1 by the correct one, N plus 1 half squared by hand, without any justification. Just because they realized that it was wrong, they didn't realize that this was not explaining the spectrum that they observed. And then, in 1937, Langer solved the problem. And here is the summary of his paper. And it's quite interesting to read this part of the summary. And you cannot see it very clearly, so I can read it for you. So it says, part two deal with the radial wave equation for motion in the central field of force, just studying the hydrogen atom. It is shown that the application of the WKB analysis to this equation, as it has generally been made, is uncritical and in error. This we know because we get the wrong Wagner equation. The failure, with quotation marks, of the W formulas and the apparent necessity for modifying them by replacing the number LL plus 1 by L plus 1 half squared has been noted by many investigators. Here it means people have just replaced, without any justification, the wrong factor by the correct one. This is traced to the misapplication of the theory. When correctly applied, the theory naturally yields the formula which has been found to be called for other grounds, it means which fits the observations or the experiments. So what was the Langer method? Well, it was very simple. If you write down the WKB wave function, so this has this form, you can show that it obeys exactly this equation. So it's almost the equation that we want, except that we have this Q term in addition. This Q term is given in terms of the derivative of the effective frequency. Now it's clear that the WKB approximation is a good approximation if Q of omega squared is small, because then this equation is equivalent to the original equation. The remark of Langer is that for very small values of r, so close to the nucleus, this condition is violated. So this simply means that the WKB approximation is violated when we consider the wave function close to the nucleus. And so the method of Langer was just to change the variable, so you change the radius and you change the wave function, such that you still obtain an equation of the form of a parametric equation, parametric oscillator equation, but now with the new variables you can apply the WKB approximation. And crucially, you see that the new frequency in terms of the new variable contains this mysterious L plus 1 half squared factor. Then you use the W approximation, you express the result in terms of x and mu, you transform it back into the original variables, and you get the exact Wagner equation. So, okay, this is a small historical, this is a small story, but what are the consequences for cosmology? Well, this shows that if you want to compute the power spectrum on large scales using the W approximation, naively, you are going to get the wrong result. And you can check it explicitly. You just take the equation for the Fourier mode, you apply the WKB approximation, you solve the equation, you compute the power spectrum, and this gives the wrong result. Exactly for the same reason I explained before. So, so this simply means that WKB approximation is violated on large scales. Now what you can do is that you can apply the cosmological version of the Langer transformation, transform the equation for the Fourier mode of your cosmological perturbations, apply the WKB approximation, go back to the original variables, compute the power spectrum, and if you do this, you can show that you get the correct results. But I wanted to show you this example for the following reason, because it gives us a criterion to decide whether we are going to get a modification in the power spectrum or not. And the modification is, the criterion is the following one. So this is the dispersion relation in the standard case, so frequency, physical frequency versus physical wave number during the sitter, so this is the Hubble parameter. This is the linear dispersion relation. So initially, the mode are smaller than the Hubble scale. This means that we are in this regime, and the WKB approximation is satisfied. So this would correspond in the analogy with the hydrogen atom to a large value of R. Then the universe is expanding, and because the universe is expanding, the point representing the evolution of the mode is moving along the dispersion relation. The mode exits the horizon, and in this regime, as I showed before, the W approximation is violated. So this gives us a hand-waving argument for deciding when WKB is violated. When the dispersion relation or when the frequency is below the Hubble scale, then the WKB approximation is violated, as you can see here. So now I can just try to do it for another dispersion relation, so for a modified dispersion relation. So just for the sake of illustration, let's take this one. So we start here. Here the WKB approximation is fulfilled simply because you see that omega physical is above the Hubble scale. Then, as the universe is expanding, the mode is moving along the dispersion relation, and at some point, the mode will penetrate in this region. Here, the W approximation will be violated, simply because omega physical is less than H. And then, we will reach the standard evolution. So certainly, for this kind of dispersion relation, the inflationary prediction will be modified. So now the question is, which kind of modification are we going to get? So again, I think it's possible to say something which is very generic, and it's possible, and the rest is very model dependent. So let's start with something which I think is quite generic. So this is again the plot of omega physical versus wave number for different dispersion relation. So here is the characteristic length. So usually what we do is that we fix the initial condition in this region. So we are within the Hubble scale. And what we do usually is that we fix the Bunch-Davis vacuum in this region. Now in the most general initial conditions in this regime, since WKB approximation is valid, is just a linear combination of positive and negative frequency. So what we do usually is we just take beta equal to zero. Now, if before that, in this regime, the WKB approximation was violated because of some Transplanckian effect, this means that during the evolution in the Transplanckian region, we have produced a non-vanishing beta coefficient. So we won't have the standard initial condition with beta equal to zero, but we will have another branch. And now you can immediately guess which kind of correction you will get to the power spectrum, because having this as initial condition, well, to compute the power spectrum, you take the modulus, you square it. And if you do this with a non-vanishing beta, you will immediately obtain a cosine or a sine. So you see that immediately you see that you will get superimposed oscillation to the power spectrum. Of course, the details will be model dependent. So the frequency, the amplitude, and so on will be model dependent. But I think that the fact that you get superimposed oscillation to the inflationary power spectrum is quite generic.
When you do the static calculation equation, you see a bunch of Davis vacuum, which is the clicking vacuum. Now, if you go below the Planck length, You don't know what the vacuum is. So how can you say anything?
Yeah, this is the essence of the Transplantian problem. Mm-hmm. This is the essence of the Transplantian problem of inflation.
Right. So I don't see how you, I presume you're going to repeat Langer.
No, no, here I'm just trying to model the physics beyond the Planck scale by this modified dispersion ratio. I'm just saying that if the evolution in this region was not adiabatic, then you will get correction to the power spectrum. And typically the correction will, I mean, typically superimposed oscillation will appear.
You call them corrections.
Sorry?
You call them corrections.
Yeah.
Which means something small happens.
Yes, but we should.
How do you know that's true?
You don't know, it depends on the model. But
it's a very model.
It's model dependent. So in this case, the amplitude of the correction, in the case of the modified dispersion relation, the amplitude of the correction will be proportional to the time spent by a given mode in the regime where the WKB approximation is violated. But there are other models. For instance, when you, as we discussed yesterday and this morning, when the scale just pop up to fix new fundamental scale, and in this case, the amplitude of the effect is just controlled by the ratio of the two scales that you have in the problem, namely the Hubble scale and the new scale. So,
I just want to make a general comment. Inflation produces two implications, effectively, apart from the rise in problem and flattens. Forget about that. One is the spectral index, and the other one is the ratio of scalar, tensor to scalar.
At least the second one is valid for single field inflation.
And as we've learned from what you said, the prediction of the spectral index is becoming fuzzy. As you add more potential fields, parameters. So what hard prediction can you test in inflation, particularly if you put in this Planck scale?
Well, this is...
How do you test it? See what I'm thinking.
I mean, this is exactly the question.
What's left?
I mean, this is exactly what I'm trying to study, whether these predictions, namely the scale invariance or even the ratio T over S, is robust towards modification of high energy physics.
How do we test inflation?
Well, if it's not robust, then it's clear that it's a problem for inflation. So, okay.
Want to try and wrap up?
Maybe what I could do is just to jump to the two or three last transparencies which describe the observational constraints.
But John, ideally, what do you need? Maybe we can find that time somewhere else in this case.
It's clear that this is now slide 33. I have 48.
So we have 3/4.
You could have used so much of my time.
Just that yes, that's right.
Should have told me.
Maybe what I do is I just jump to the observational constraints and I stop. If it's fine for
you. Don't jump. Just go quickly through so we can say stop.
Okay. So, as I've argued before, typically what you expect are superimposed oscillations in the Bohr spectrum. So, now the question is, first of all, whether we are going to transfer this superimposed oscillation in the Bohr spectrum to the multipole moment. And then, if so, whether we can use the CMB data to put constraint on the amplitude, the frequency, or even the phase of these oscillations. The answer to the first question is yes, as you can show here. If you have this superimposed oscillation in the initial power spectrum, you will see them in the C of T. And here is an explicit demonstration. You can see this tiny superimposed oscillation in the C of L that we have computed using a CMB code.
But
they're
not
this one?
Yeah, this size of
I come to that. I come to the constraints.
Well, when you do the calculation of these oscillatory peaks,
the small one, you mean?
Not
the acoustic.
The three peaks.
Ah, the acoustic peaks.
When you do the first, second, and third peaks, which are the critical peaks, you get a good approximation by putting. You have the amplitude is not predicted by inflation. You want to take the minus 5. So you have to put that in by hand. So when you put in the spectral index, you put it out to 1. You get a good fit. So it's not an Aristotle test. The data there is not Aristotle test in the limit.
No, but this is not about test inflation, it's about testing perturbation from inflation.
But that's the point I'm making.
Yeah.
Any changes you get from transplanting, you claim you're small.
But just maybe we can because you're ready for lunch.
I mean, maybe if you want, I can stop here.
This is important.
Okay. So the first claim is that if you have superimposed oscillation in the power spectrum, they are transferred to the multiple domains, as you can see here. Then what you can do is to try to fit this power spectrum with these oscillations to the WMAP3 data. If you do this, the following happens. You get a drop in the chi-square, which is equal to minus 12 for 3 extra parameters. So 3 extra parameters, the amplitude, the frequency, and the phase. So just to give you an idea of what it means, maybe you know there was a paper by Linde and collaborators where they have introduced a sharp cutoff at large scales in order to describe the low quadrupole. This was for the first year WMAP data. And if you do this, it's clear that you improve the fit of your data. But the chi-square that you get in this case is minus 3. So it's, you see that it's delta chi-square of minus 12 is not, I mean, it's not something that we can just ignore at the very beginning. At least we have to see what it means. Now you get, you get some constraint on the amplitude at 2 sigma. I see this one.
Sorry, what does it mean?
So x sigma 0 is just the amplitude of the oscillations.
The superimposed one?
Superimposed oscillations.
In the unit of what?
It's dimensionless. Sigma 0 is just the ratio of h over n, the scale of new physics. So the power spectrum is 1 plus x sigma 0 times cosine of logarithm of k, roughly speaking.
So sigma 0 is 10 to the minus 5?
I don't know, because I don't know the scale of inflation, I don't know the scale of...
Sorry, what I don't understand is that you have both x and sigma 0. If sigma 0 is unfixed, what does it mean, x sigma 0?
If you want, I can call it A for amplitude. A is less than 0.38.
And the amplitude in the unit of 10 to the minus 5?
It's power spectrum is the Slow-Roll power spectrum 1 plus A cosine of log K.
So in the unit of it.
Okay. So, so for strange reasons, I have decided to write A as x as 0, but I have the right to do it. Okay, so we have this, so we have this drop in the chi-square, and now the question is it statistically significant? And before addressing this question, I just would like to make the following remark. These are the W map 1 data, these are the W map 3 data, and you see that this famous cosmic variance outlier has disappeared. But nevertheless, you still get a quite large drop in the chi-square. So this means that you cannot, I mean, first, the reason why you get this drop in the chi-square does not depend only on one point. And the second thing is that it's not possible to compute the chi-square just by eye. You have to do it seriously. So now let's come to the to see whether this is statistically significant. And here is, so this is again the marginalized probabilities for various parameters. So this is the distribution for epsilon 1, epsilon 2, so the two first order parameters. This is here the frequency, this is here the amplitude, x sigma 0, the phase, and the amplitude of the power spectrum. So now what you see is the following one. So it turns out that it's a quite complicated situation from a statistical point of view. Namely, if you consider marginalized probability, this is the black curve, you see that the vanishing value of the amplitude is still favored. You see that the curve is peaked at the vanishing value for the amplitude. But now if you consider the mean likelihood, you see that you favor a non-vanishing value of the amplitude. And this can be very well understood, because the mean likelihood is something which is sensitive to the only to the value of the likelihood, while the marginalized probabilities is something which is sensitive to the value of the likelihood, but also to the volume occupied by the best fit in the parameter space. So it's clear that this oscillation, they occupy a very small volume in the parameter space, because if you just shift a little bit the oscillations, then the improvement of the chi-square is not so good. So you need to lock the oscillations quite precisely in order to get this drop in the chi-square. So this means that in the parameter space, they occupy a very small volume. And this is exactly why you get, for the marginalized probability, you still get a vanishing value. So now it's a question of, some people trust the marginalized probability, some others trust the mean likelihood. So the people who trust the marginalized probability, they trust the Bayesian point of view. And the people who trust the mean likelihood, they trust the frequentist point of view. It depends whether you are frequentist or Bayesian. Usually, I must say that people say that it's reasonable to be also sensitive to the volume occupied by the best fit in the parameter space. So in this case, given the data that we have, a vanishing amplitude is still the best solution, and in this case, this best fit is not statistically significant. If you are Bayesian, then this is statistically significant. So, what we have done also.
Frequentist, that's different.
If you are frequentist, it's significant, sorry. So, what we have done is we have tested another shape for the oscillation, because maybe you can just take any oscillatory shape, and maybe automatically you always get the same drop in the chi-square. So what we have, in order to test this, we have taken another form of the power spectrum, and I have no time to go through this, but the bottom line is that taking another shape not predicted by this transport and model, you don't get the same drop in the chi-square. So the fit is less good in this case. So it seems that the logarithmic shape, so so to say with quotation mark, the transport and shape is, again, with quotation mark, favored by this data.
So can you provide an explanation why the amplitude you get, let's say, possibilities with the amplitude of modification of the order of 0.40, that is 40%, and whatnot? How can we, with eyes, we simply don't see any oscillation with amplitude of 40%? It looks so...
No, it's not true. I mean...
40%?
Yeah. You see, you have the error bars. I mean, you just...
Is it due to a
It's not because you just... You are used to the curve, which is smooth.
But no, but the experimental data seem in much smaller discrepancy than 40%. It looks like, I don't know, a few percent. When you look at individual dots, the black dots, even that you just wrote, with respect to the theoretical curve,
yeah,
it's really within the cosmic variance. So if I make my analysis for L around, I don't know, 100 cosmic variance being small, how can I get 40% as a possible amplitude for the modification? I simply don't understand. You see my question? Look at your expression. P is equal to P standard 1 plus 40%. If you draw that curve...
The answer is probably that you're folding these oscillations in the primordial spectrum with a particular wavelength.
Ah, because there is a washing out mechanism.
Yeah. In order to get to the CLs.
I don't know. A is over P.
Look.
Ah. It's P of K, not P of... It's not CL.
That's what you're doing. It's from three dimensions to two dimensions.
I see your question now.
No, I understand.
If you go back a few slides, you had this other part where you only show the modification.
Yeah, I understand that point too. From that, you still have to compute the C of L.
It's because of the washing out mechanism that you can and see the very large.
Yeah, and in fact, if you just put a feature in the Bauer spectrum, not oscillation, this feature is completely washed out by the convolution with the Bessel function. But oscillations are not just a feature. They are everywhere in the k-space. So this is the reason why they survive. So but nevertheless, there is some washing.
So can you give an order of magnitude of the efficiency of the washing out mechanism? That is, if it is 40%, how much it is reduced? Is it really reduced to 2% or to 1%?
Yes. Well, I showed you the
part of the scale.
Exactly. Yes.
The washing out mechanism is really half-plus or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. When you have just a feature, if you add a Gaussian, for instance, because of the convolution, because of this washing, it completely disappears from the CL.
Irrespectively of the frequency, that is the cost.
When you just put a... If you put a feature,
right,
not superimposed oscillation, if you just put a feature in the Bauer spectrum,
right,
at a given scale, so you just add, you have the scale invariant Bauer spectrum and you add a Gaussian, for instance, at a given scale with a given width,
right,
then you can show that because of this, what you call the washing out,
yeah,
the convolution between the Bessel function and the Bauer spectrum, this is completely washed out. But now, why does it survive in our case? It's because it's not a feature at a specific k in the Bauer spectrum. We have oscillations, so they are everywhere in the k space. And this is why, when you just compute the convolution in order to get the C of n, something survives.
So you see that any feature center of the line is completely erased by the...
Yeah, this is a famous paper by Wen Wu. Couple of years ago, that's short. It's just a convolution.
Okay.
Maybe I stop.
Stop here. Let's
see. I think we'll see the email from the kitchen. They say that at 1 o'clock the crowd is going to come, so we better go there now. Oh, yes, and remember that's a long break now. This is in 4, but Ted will give the PI colloquium at 2.
No, I don't want to do it.